It's working. Good morning, Boker Tov, everyone. Welcome. We're continuing our discussion of Emuna. And it's a really opportune time as we approach Tisha B'Av to think about today's issue as it relates to Emuna and questions, challenges that we have in Emuna. We started this series several weeks ago with an assumption, and that Emuna is a feeling, an awareness, an experience. Last week we mentioned this, and I'll use it as a point of departure today. The trouble with all rational demonstrations of the existence of God, with which the history of philosophy abounds, consists in their being exactly what they were meant to be by those who formulated: abstract, logical demonstrations divorced from the living, primal experiences in which these demonstrations are rooted. So says Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik in his footnote in The Lonely Man of Faith, who then points out, does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? It's an awareness, it's a feeling, it's a reality. There's a story that captures this idea of the awareness, of the feeling of Emuna, the closest to Hashem. A story of a poetry contest in a small English town. Imagine the countryside, small village. But every year in the springtime, in May, they set up a big tent outside of the town square, just on the lawn opposite the town hall, and they host the national poetry reading contest for all of England. And people come from near and far to recite poetry and to deliver it. And people are inspired, they're in awe, they're moved, it's incredible. Every year, people arrive, they line up, and they put their name down to have this opportunity to deliver their poetry. And there's one guy, one scholar, an Oxford-trained Cambridge professor, who every year speaks, and almost every year he wins. The poetry that he delivers is magisterial. It's incredible. So he is put at the bottom of the list to give everybody else a chance to speak first. And Vayi Ayom comes that day for the poetry contest, and there are thousands of people milling about in this town on the main street, and there's the sign up under the tent, whoever would like to sign up to read their poetry. And over the course of the morning, people shuffle in and they sign up. Finally, toward the afternoon, before the sign-up sheet is closed, a little man, short, with a cap, one of those black Kangol caps, and a thin, wispy beard, and a little walking stick, he hobbles over and he puts his name down. He wants to recite a piece of poetry. So he's the last guy to show up. He's the last guy to speak, to deliver the poetry. Meanwhile, right before him is this Cambridge professor. The professor gets up and he delivers a piece of Wordsworth, and people, they are breathtaking. They just can't move. They're shocked at how unbelievable and awesome. He finishes and there is a thunderous applause as he walks off the little homemade stage that's comprised of a few tables put together that he's standing on. He gets off the stage, and they call the name of this last man, who hobbles to the front, gently walks up the makeshift stairs onto the platform. He stands at the lectern, and he says he's going to recite the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." The man gets up there. He puts on a pair of glasses. He looks down. He opens up an old, worn book, and he starts reading, "The Lord is my shepherd." A psalm of David. "The Lord is my shepherd. I will not want." One line at a time, and he speaks in a very distinct, Eastern European accent. He's looking down the entire time, each phrase. Finally, he finishes. I will sit in the house of God for the longest days. He folds up his little Tehillim and he walks off the stage. And he catches a glimpse out of his eye that everyone's crying. There's not a dry eye under the tent in the main square in this country village in England. They say, we're going to convene for a couple of minutes as judges and decide. So everyone starts milling around. This one goes for a drink. The other one uses a restroom. The Cambridge professor, he's being mobbed by people talking to him, but he makes his way through the crowd and he finds this little older man and he leans over to me and says, sir, can you explain to me something? Why is it that when I recited my poetry, everyone clapped when I finished? And when you recited your poetry, everyone cried. And the man looked up to him and he said, the difference is that I know the shepherd. That's what emuna means. The Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapira, Hashem Yikom Domo, Zchus Yagen Aleinu, the Halakha Piyasetzta Rebbe, he has a diary. It's called Tzav Ziras. And in this diary, he mentions in Chelek Yud Gimel, there's an English translation that I'll share with you. He says, certainly you have heard or seen the books that deal with the existence of God. For those who find it hard to believe, they try to prove that there is a God. They bring their proofs from the creation itself, its inherent wisdom, but woe for you if you need their proofs. Have you not felt, have you not seen how your soul is so sure it sees God? You speak to him in second person, in formal and informal prayer, because the truth is that your soul does not see him present right there before you. Your soul does see him. And when your soul cries out in pain, picks up a verse from Psalms 23. When you pour out your soul, you say, God, please bring me closer. Help me surrender my very self to you, because I yearn greatly to come closer. So why do you need abstract proof of God that exists if your soul knows and sees for itself? We feel it. We know it. That's what we spoke about last week when we talked about personal nurturing our personal connection to Hashem through emuna. But here's the problem. The problem is not that we don't believe that God exists. Of course we do. Of course we believe. The problem is, how do we believe that with life experience? We have questions. We have questions that if Hashem is so close to us and he loves us and he's near to us and he's walking along with us, so then so many things we look around, we say, how could it be? It's not that we don't believe. It's not that we would be much better off if we had some philosophical, rational proof. That's not the problem. The problem is we look around and we see injustice. We see suffering. We see so much pain. And we say, Rabboni Shalom, if you're right here, how could this be? How could it be? The biggest challenge to emuna for many people, it's nothing to do with philosophy. It's not about intellectual query. It's about, on the one hand, you're telling me, I know the shepherd, but how is the shepherd allowing this? How is this happening? I know the shepherd. So what is this? How could this be? The Navi Chavakuk describes how he stands on a mountain and he screams out to Rabboni Shalom. He says, God, how could this be? How could it be that the righteous are suffering and the wicked are succeeding? It's what we call the age-old question of tzaddik v'ralo. That's our problem. That's our question. That's our doubt. And perhaps what we need to recognize is that we can have emuna while living with that question. Let's think back. The first shiur, the first discussion, the basic definition of Yiddishkeit that we set out is emuna. We quoted the pasuk that the Gemara cites in the end of Maseches Makos, The tzaddik be'emunaso yichya. The tzaddik, the righteous person, the one who is fulfilling his spiritual dream, lives with his emuna. Do you know who said that pasuk? Do you remember? Chavakuk. The same man who stood at the top of the mountain and yelled at the Borei Olam, he says, how could it be? He's the same person who says, tzaddik be'emunaso yichya. It's possible to have emuna, relationships with Hashem, a relationship with God, and also have questions, also yell at God, also challenge God. We could even argue that challenging HaKadosh Baruch Hu, asking God, pleading with Him, yelling at Him, is not a challenge to emuna, but an affirmation of emuna. You know who lived this way? Elie Wiesel, Zichrono Livracha, lived this way. You know, when Elie Wiesel taught in BU, had an interesting teaching style. When he would quote a pasuk, he would put on his yarmulke. And when he was not quoting a pasuk, he was just teaching secular in the university, he would take off his yarmulke. So sometimes his teaching assistant described half the class, yarmulke on, off, on, off. He was very aware of the Rabbon Shalom's Yiddishkeit. And he describes how in that place where he was, in the kingdom of night in Auschwitz, there were people who challenged God, who yelled at him, and then they davened Ma'ariv. He had that own experience himself. He was interviewed once, some of you are familiar with the NPR podcast series, the radio program called On Being. Before that, the woman who runs, her name is Krista Tippett. Before that, the podcast, I think it was called, a radio show called Speaking of Faith. So she interviewed Elie Wiesel, and she said to him, not in these words, but she said to him, Reb Yid, Elie Wiesel, you're a Jew. And you talk so much about how God was burnt up that first night that you got there, and how people challenged God and questioned God, and you have no answers for God, and you can't defend Him. So how could it be that you don't believe in God after your upbringing? That's not exactly how she phrased it, but she said, well, it must be you don't believe in God. Elie Wiesel said, you don't understand. Don't you remember? Right after all of that, I went to Davin. Because Elie Wiesel said, quote, God is in the questions. An unbelievable Maisa. Unbelievable Maisa. This Maisa was told by Reb Abba Weingort. Unfortunately, some of you are familiar with the Sridi Eish, Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha, Zeket Tzadik Livracha. The Sridi Eish was one of the greatest geniuses and giants of pre-war Europe. It happened to be, he was the Rosh Yeshiva on the one end of the Beis Medrash of Larbonin in Berlin. He was in Berlin before the war until it was closed to Kristallnacht. And then at the outbreak of the war, he happened to be in Warsaw. When he was caught in Warsaw, since he was actually a Russian citizen, he was sent to a POW camp in Germany, and he survived the war. Although his Talmidim, his life's work, everything was destroyed. He had one chief Talmud, and even this Talmud, Rav Abba Weingort, unfortunately died in an accident. He had a very tragic life. So he wrote four volumes of Tshuvas called Sridi Eish. And his Ksavim, a lot of his Torah was a credit to his students who collected them and saved these. It's a whole amazing story. So he had this one chief Talmud, his close Talmud. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, so this story was from Rav Abba Weingart, in the name of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who met Rav Shlomo Aronson, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. So if Shlomo Aronson told over the following story. In 1933, it was the 30th anniversary of the massacres in Kishinev, in the terrible pogroms of Kishinev. So they got together in Tel Aviv to have a memorial to the people, the Jews who were murdered in Kishinev. And they had a group of speakers, and at the end, they had one survivor of the Kishinev pogrom who was going to recite the Kaddish. When it was his turn to say Kaddish, this Jew got up in Tel Aviv in 1933, and he started, Lo Yiskadal Velo Yiskadash Shmei Rabba. It should not be glorified. It should not be sanctified, his great name. And the people were shocked. They were mamish shocked. they stopped him, they pulled him off the stage, and the meeting ended, the event ended, people were upset. And Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, he heard this from Rav Aronson, and he said, that's the most truthful person in the room. Because he gave a shtickle Torah, which we're not going to have time for, about Acher and Reb Meir. He said, this man, this angry man, believed so much in the Ribono Shel Olam. He believed in an all-powerful God. And he said, this is a Chilul Hashem, it's not a Kiddush Hashem. Challenging HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you have a relationship with him, is an affirmation. It's not calling him into question. It's calling him into question, but not out of a lack of emunah, but rather because of emunah. To say lo yiskadal is also, it's also emunah. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, he would come to the Ribbono Shel Olam Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and he would say, how ashamed you are when you come to us this Rosh Hashanah, this Yom Kippur, after all the tzaras you gave us. Avada, you have to be mochel us for all of our averus. We'll do you a favor, Ribbono Shel Olam. We'll swap you, our averus, for all the tzaras you gave us, and you still get the better end of the deal. If it weren't for us, who would bring God into the world? It's a rachmanas on you. So was the Berdichever a man of no faith or of the greatest faith? Because he had this deep, abiding connection and relationship that they were so close that he could call him to task. Who was the source of Emuna? Avram Avinu, Echad Hu Avram. And what does Avram Avinu do when he sees the destruction of Sodom? He says, could it be? Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaaseh mishpat? Are you not going to do the right thing, kiviyachol? You're going to let these people go? You're going to kill them? What do you mean, Avraham Avinu? You're the Rosh HaMaaminim. You should believe. If God says it, it must be, and that's okay. And leave it alone. Avraham Avinu says no. What we need to understand when we approach Tisha B'Av, when we think about Emuna and the suffering and the difficulties and the Tzadik V'Ralo, and we could spend an entire day and 2 days and 10 days exploring the different approaches in Chazal to Tzadik V'Ralo, but at the end of the day, the most important thing to remember is that we have to remember that on the number one, it's possible to have emunah and live with questions. But number two, the questions that we ask of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are not undermining our emunah, they are affirming it. There's a fellow in our neighborhood, should have good health, Hashem should give him besuras tovos. His name is Dr. Jerry Loeb, Rabbi Dr. Jerry Loeb. He's a prominent psychologist here in Chicago. And he is the child of survivors. And he told me that he would have discussions with his father, Zichron Levracha, who survived a very difficult period during the war, many places we don't want to talk about. And he would ask his father certain questions about Hashem, about Emunah, about God. And his father would always say the same thing. In Yiddish, he would say, there's a father in heaven. There's a father in heaven. He had a belief and he had questions. And those aren't contradictory. Rav Yehuda Amital was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion. He was the founder of this remarkable institution that began on a hilltop in Kfar Etzion shortly after the liberation of Yehuda and Shomron after 1967. But his life really came from Europe. His world was from Romania, from Transylvania, where he grew up as a young boy, and he spent the war for several months as a slave laborer after his parents had been taken away and his family was killed. His original name before it was Amital was Klein, and he worked in this slave labor camp until ultimately he came to Israel, went to the Chevron Yeshiva, to Knesset Yisrael, and he became one of the great Rosh Yeshiva of our time on many levels. One of the things about Rav Amital was his enthusiasm for Yiddishkeit, not just from an academic sense as a traditional Rosh Yeshiva, but his nigunim. I have several chaverim here in Skokie who are talmidim of Yeshivat Har Etzion. And once in a while, some years before Yom Noroim, my colleague, my friend, my dear chaver, Rabbi Menachem Lenzer, Rabbi Lenzer, he studied in Yeshivat Har Etzion, so he'll send me some nigunim from Rav Amital, who was the Baal Tfila for Yom Noroim in Yeshivat Har Etzion for many years. So at the end of his life, one of his last public interviews he gave was to a secular Israeli magazine called Eretz Acheret. And they asked him, they said, Rav Amital, how could it be that you went through what you went through, the Holocaust, the desolation, the destruction, the personal loss, the anguish that you feel, and he spoke about it often, that you've related to so many times, that you saw that destruction with your own eyes, and yet you still have the capacity to be the Baal Tefillah, to sing those nigunim, to dance with the Rabbono Shel Olam. Li'avdecha Be'emes, one of his big nigunim, it was actually a volume that was called, I believe it's called, La'avdecha Be'emes. It was published about Rav Amital after he passed away. Rav Amital said, it's not a stira. It's not a stira. When it comes to the Shoah, when it comes to the Holocaust, I stand before a wall. Questions. There are questions. And I don't have any answers to those questions. But those questions do not preclude me from still having a relationship with the Rabbono Shel Olam. Without being held back. He said, I once met Abba Kovner. Some of you have heard of Abba Kovner. He was a great leader of the Jews in the Vilna ghetto. He was a great intellectual, but then he became a great activist. I'm going to slide over because I think it's hard for you to see here. Your son. Abba Kovner, he was one of the people in charge of the resistance, the underground in the Warsaw ghetto. So Rav Mital met him after the war. Rav Mital said, I asked Abba Kovner, which one of us is better off? Are you better off because you weren't religious, you weren't spiritual, you didn't believe in God? Or am I better off? Well, let's see. You believed in man, and now look where you are now. I believed in God. When I believed in God before the war, I had a lot of questions. We've always had questions about God. God is mysterious. As Elie Wiesel pointed out, God is in the questions. I had questions before, and I have questions afterwards. And the ability, Rav Amital teaches us, and Elie Wiesel teaches us, and Reb Levi Yitzchak, and ultimately Chavakuk teaches us, the ability to live with this challenge is what we are called upon to do, and what we have within us. The fact that we have emunah that is deep-rooted within us, that we have received, as we spoke about the last 2 weeks, both in a tradition from our parents, whether it's in our inherent in our genes, or it's something that we saw through Masorah, or we learned, or it's something that we explored personally and we're nurturing, that's something that is going to exist on a deeper level than even all the questions that we have. And so as difficult as it is, as challenging as it is, the answer, perhaps, to this issue of tzaddik v'ralo, of emuna, of questions, is not to run to philosophical answers, although there are many, and the Gemara has many different, and Chazal have many different approaches, but really to dig even deeper into that inner emuna, into that awareness that we started with, which lives with those painful questions, but at the same time is comforted. Shivtecho mishantecho hema yinachamuni. That we don't understand it. And Rav Mital says, yes, to say atav achartonu mikol amim, sometimes he said was difficult, was hard. People are going through tzaras, rachman al nitzlan, it's not easy. But to realize that we're not alone, and that the fact that we have questions doesn't mean the Rabbono Shel Olam is not there and not with us. He is there, he is with us. That's that lo ira ra ki ata imadi. The Rabbono Shel Olam is with us at all that time. And if we have that deep sense that the Rabbono Shel Olam is with us, and that there's an awareness of a profound feeling of emunah, then it's not heresy to challenge him and to cry to him and say, how could you do this to me? That's what we're going to do on Tisha B'Av. We don't do it every day of the year, but at Tisha B'Av, we're going to say Eicha. The word Eicha means, how is it possible? On the one hand, we say, of course, Mipnei Chata'inu, there are a lot of good reasons. But at the end of the day, we say, despite all those good reasons, but you're our shepherd. How could this happen? How could you do this to us? But even though we're going to say Eicha Yashva Badad, we're still going to have the strength to say Yiskadal V'Yiskad Hashmei Rabbah. We're going to understand that the Rabbono Shel Olam is living in the questions. And for some, this is an inexorable problem. But if we hold on to those people who came before us, or those people in our lives who are able, the Rav Amitals, the Elie Wiesels, the Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev, the Chavakuks, the Moshe Rabbeinu, who asked God, I need to see, I need to understand, and God said no. If we hold on to them, we can reinforce our emuna, and not only can these challenges not shatter or fracture our emuna, they can actually bring us to a deeper connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Hopefully this will all be theoretical. Mashiach will be here very shortly. I want to give a special welcome to Zev Schwartz from Torah Mitzion, our partner, who keeps us connected to Eretz Yisrael, to Torah Yisrael. And we're looking forward. We still have time, especially in Chicago. We're 8 hours behind you. If Mashiach comes, we can get there even, you know, we'll all be ready to go. If Mashiach doesn't come, we'll still observe Tisha B'Av, but the Tisha B'Av is not going to take away from our Amunah. The suffering of generations is not going to take us away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our Amunah. It's just going to enable us to take the space, to take the time to see it, to own it, to deal with it, and to reflect on it for ourselves. Everybody should have an easy fast, a meaningful fast. Besuras, Tovos, Yeshuas, Menachamos, for all of Klal Yisrael, and thank you for joining me. Have a great day. Emir Tashem.